November 12th to December 2nd, one of North America's major documentary film festivals will take place.
Montreal International Documentary Festival.
RIDM.
A 23rd edition, more engaged and accessible than ever.
In a virtual format never seen before.
The program includes the 100 best documentaries of the year.
This fall, we will be online, where all stories meet.
And you?
Check out our website at ridm.ca.
Welcome to Dragonroot Radio, feminist waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragonroot Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragonroot understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
Welcome to Dragonroot Radio. Later in the month of November, we'll be chatting about environmental justice and its intersection with gender. And in preparation for that episode, we were looking back at a piece we did a few years ago that features Maya from Missing Justice. Maya speaks about environmental racism in Canada. Keep in mind, this was a few years ago, and there have been some developments and setbacks since, but much of what Maya shares is just as relevant today in our approach to environmental justice. Stay tuned.
Maya of Missing Justice speaks about environment, race, and gender, where they meet, where they converge, and how they never should have been thought about separately. Do stay tuned. This is CKUT 90.3 FM.
The first little anecdote I wanted to share, I thought was a good illustration of just the type of dynamic, the type of lack of, I don't even like saying lack of analysis or lack of intersectionality, because it's those words are both really annoying to me. And really, like, not everyone understands what they mean and so on, but I guess because I'm standing up here talking about environment, race, and gender, we are talking about where they meet, where they converge, and how they should never have been thought about separately at all to begin with. So there's this little anecdote. Has anyone seen the documentary Pickaxe? This is where these images are from. Okay, so thought it would just be better to sum up a little bit one of the things that happens or that gets depicted in this documentary rather than show you a clip, because there's no one clip that would really do it. But basically, this story is meant to look at our own, for those of us that are involved in activist or social justice groups or circles, to look at the power dynamics that happen in our own involvements. So this documentary is about, like, in the 1990s in Oregon, and about this group of activists that were fighting against clear-cutting that was happening. They really managed to drum up a lot of support, got a lot of international attention. Cascadia, there was a lot of chaining bodies to trees and a lot of media attention and a lot of just, it was a high-profile thing. It went on for months and months, and they managed to delay the cutting for a long time. But basically, one of the things that I thought was really interesting that gets depicted in this documentary is just the dynamic between the men and women in the group. You had a situation where, and I don't think this is an isolated situation, from my own experiences, I know it's not, my own conversations, where a lot of the actual, like locking down and like getting arrested and doing a lot of the menial work was done by women, and a lot of the talking to media, being on camera, doing interviews was done by men. I mean, that's, you know, maybe that's all fine and dandy if that's the way everyone in the group wants it. You know, I mean, it's one thing to say we all are doing what we want to be doing anyway, and it's another thing to tokenize someone and tell them to do something they don't want to do just because they're a woman, and I've experienced that as well. But in this documentary, there was at least 15 minutes devoted to the fact that the women were not happy with the situation, that there was a lot of bitterness going on between members of the group as a result of this gender divide. A lot of the men in the group who were interviewed about it, the response was along the lines of, well, clearly it's important. Clearly these deep-seated gender dynamic issues among our group are really important. However, we need to deal with the urgent matters first. The urgent matters such as saving the forest, and getting the word out, and that's more urgent. And once that's dealt with, once we save the trees, then we can deal with the more deep-seated issues after that. Because clearly there's like a hierarchy of priority here. They didn't use those words, those are my words. I'm just pointing to this as an example of sort of problematic that exists everywhere we turn, because in a way everything's always urgent. I would liken this to certain environmental NGOs in Canada even, who are going ahead with trying to strike deals often with government and logging companies because it's urgent, without consulting First Nations, because it's urgent, the types of dynamics that creates. So whether we're talking about not dealing with gender issues as they come up, not dealing with First Nations issues, nation-to-nation issues as they come up, no matter what it is, if we're not dealing with every human as they're involved and like excluding a certain group of people and not consulting them, then we're just going to replicate the same really terrible capitalist patriarchal power dynamics that were supposed to be trying to that supposedly created these problems to begin with, right? So, and then we end up having to start all over again, or maybe we don't have time to do that. I don't know. So that's just one story. And here in Canada, as I just mentioned, there's also been a lot of drama in the last few years around something called the Canadian Boreal Initiative. Organizations such as Greenpeace going ahead without consulting First Nations, and lots of battles going on there. Same type of dynamic.
In the next clip from the Gender and Environmental Racism workshop, Maya of Missing Justice addresses reproductive justice and population growth. Do stay tuned.
That's our Prime Minister Hadford and International Cooperation Minister Bev Oda at the time. And I don't know if any of you remember back in 2010 when the G20 summits happened and Harper's so-called maternal health initiative for other countries was unveiled. The segue is, okay, the same dynamics exist on the governmental level. Which one's worse? I don't know. I think they're both pretty bad. On this level, you had Bev Oda at the time sort of being quoted as saying, basically there was Harper was championing maternal health at the time and saying, and we really care about the health of mothers and children across the globe. But at the same time as he was saying this, he was sort of recreating almost identical to George W. Bush's model for the 8 years he was in office, where his foreign aid policy sort of banned support for aid organizations that were supporting abortion in so-called developing countries. So Harper announced during these summits in 2010, or his government announced, that contraception would not be included in these packages. And then Bev Oda was quoted as saying, when we know what we can do by providing clean water, vaccinations, better nutrition, blah, 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 then maybe we'll deal with, blah, you know, this. So again, it's a similar thing as was happening in the Pickaxe documentary, where we're saying, okay, these things are more urgent. Clearly the power differences are much more pronounced in this particular example. And then people were pointing to this type of foreign policy, this like disastrously racist and sexist foreign policy, as being the government's way, our current government's way of also creating an environment domestically within the country where maybe the debate can be reopened here too. Maybe it's not so unfathomable. And then you have, you know, throughout the last couple of years since then, all sorts of attempts to reopen the abortion debate here in the country as well, as I'm sure a lot of you have heard of. 312, just a few months ago, our very own Status of Women Minister Rona Ambrose votes to reopen the debate. Luckily, it got shut down anyway, but her argumentation for it was that she feared that people would seek out abortions based on sex discrimination. So as to say that her concern was that people would abort their abort because they knew they were having girls. And first of all, I've never heard of that being an issue here, but if it was, that would definitely not, the solution would definitely not be, in my personal opinion, to curb the reproductive freedoms of women living in the country. So I bring this up because of what I like to call the politics of population growth. And population growth, I mean, I think awareness is growing around this not really being the case and not being true in recent years, but population growth has been blamed for everything across the world, from deforestation to civil wars to lack of resources and so on. I just don't think anything could be less true. and this way of thinking and this way of pointing to population growth as being responsible in any way for these problems not only points the finger and places blame on women, but women in majority world countries. The same women who are not being whose access to contraception and abortion is being cut off by our own government. So you have a double-edged thing here, where not only you have a situation where women, and I will say the women with the least access to money and certain types of choices in the majority of the world are being simultaneously blamed. Maybe not directly, but between the lines of our discourse, for overpopulation and using up too many resources and contributing to the world's problems in that way, and simultaneously barred from accessing the resources they might use should they choose to not have more children, for example. So it's really, really like doubly, triply problematic on a number of levels. And at the same time as all of this, as this double blame and barred access, this dynamic enables and facilitates continued land and resource theft in the very places where these women and their communities are from. And Canada is among the worst, since our entire economy is just completely based both here and abroad, both in First Nations communities here, communities in other countries, on land and resource theft, ongoing land and resource theft. So it's both really simple and really complicated at the same time. Hopefully that makes sense to people. I also wanted to bring up just really briefly that Canada has a history of other very clearly, at least in my mind and in the minds of many, politically motivated reproductive justice rights violations. So basically another one is that up until the 70s, there were eugenics boards in Canada that were forcing sterilization among communities of Native women in First Nations communities. All sorts of tests were sort of run on various groups of people, largely First Nations people. Evaluations were done on who was fit to procreate and who wasn't. I'm being really reductive here, but it's worth looking up if you're interested in this or talking to me later. But there's been lots of politically motivated, and one could even say capital and resource acquisition motivated, attacks on women's reproductive rights.
You are listening to Dragon Root Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM. In the next clip from the Gender and Environmental Racism Workshop, Maya of Missing Justice speaks about the resistance of Indigenous communities, including the community of Fort Chipewyan, to tar sands expansion. Maya also speaks about an example of environmental racism in Nova Scotia. Do stay tuned.
Well, basically, just to give you a quick rundown, Fort Chip is a community of 1,200 people. And at the time that I had gone, and I'm sure there's larger numbers now, there were 5 to 10 in process figuring out how many. There were people coming up with this rare cancer of the bile duct and dying. People 16 years old, 25 years old, getting all different types of cancers besides that type as well. Two-headed fish were being found. Normally this one type of rare bile duct cancer is found like 1 in 100,000 people, and we're talking about a community of 1,200 people. And there was a doctor there by the name of John McDonald, I think, who was actually a non-Native man who had committed his life to working in Fort Chipewyan, which is what the place is called. And he was threatened a number of times by the government for being an alarmist, because he was actually confirming what patients were saying. Definitely credit to him, because he kept on with it in spite of threats and almost lost his medical practice and so on. And for a number of years, there was a refusal to do proper environmental assessments, saying that these sicknesses and these deaths even had nothing to do with the tar sands. In the end, it was discovered, because there was finally proper scientific research done. There's actually a great documentary called H2 Oil about the situation there, which would seriously kick anybody's ass, which I recommend watching. finally it was discovered that, yes, there are lethal levels of arsenic in their water and so on. And yes, in fact, these deaths and cancers are linked to the tar sands. Yet still, of course, nothing's been done. The community is actually still in the process of taking the Alberta government to court, to the Supreme Court. But this is by no means slowed what's going on there, which is one of, if not the largest and most damaging mega project, environmental oil extraction mega project in the world. One of the elders that I visited there at the time, who my partner and I stayed with, Selena, was telling us about how there's a neighboring town, maybe about a decade ago, largely white town, who was complaining about deadly black green gas and bad odors and coughing and so on, and their complaints were actually dealt with, and that particular plant was closed down. However, there have been protests and resistance on all levels by various First Nations communities, including Fort Chipewyan, Fort Mackay, and others, right in the path of the tar sands. And so far, nothing's been heeded, and it took years to even get proper environmental assessment. So we could draw our own conclusions, perhaps. And then I also wanted to cite as an example, has anyone heard of Lincolnville, Nova Scotia? It's a small-ish community in Nova Scotia, largely people of African descent living there. Basically, there's this whole thing, it's still going on right now. I learned a little bit about it when I was there a few years ago. But there's basically two really massive leaking landfills in their community. Basically, one of them was opened. The first one was opened in 1974. It's basically, quote, a hole in the ground with no monitoring for the first 25 years, and still leaks. Again, as with Fort Chipewyan, abnormally high rates of rare cancers, right from the start, 1974, and again with the opening of the second one in 2006. The second one opened. Both times, massive protests, nothing done to stop it. There was a comparison made by some people, some of the people at Nova Scotia PIRG, so like QPIRG but in Nova Scotia, about how some people in the community of Sackville, who also had a landfill, and who were also complaining about loss of quality of life and loss of enjoyment of their homes and so on back in the 90s, they actually received a $5 million compensation and the landfill was closed down. This is a predominantly white community in the same province, not too far away. To quote one of the people working at NS PIRG, because I just thought it summed it up well, he says, "I look at how the concerns of the citizens of Lower Sackville were handled in the 1990s when it came to the landfill in their community, and how the citizens of Lincolnville are being treated, and I can only conclude that this is environmental racism. In the case of Sackville, the landfill was closed, a multi-million dollar leachate collection system was installed, and the residents and community compensated. In 2011, African Nova Scotians deserve better. They're still having meetings and nothing's been done so far." So I just want to illustrate that this is happening all over to communities of color and First Nations communities, not just in Canada, but all over the world in different ways.
That was three clips from a gender and environmental racism workshop facilitated by Maya, a member of Missing Justice. For more information on Justice for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, an autonomous working group of the 2110, you can check out missingjustice.ca.
You're a silent forest. You're a wild flower.
the wildfire. But you're a sharpened arrow, a spear in heart, stone cold. And you're a red-winged blackbird, perched up on the window. Darkest of wars. He never gave you time or the space to soar. But you're a sharpened arrow that tried to spear a heart stone cold. And you're a red-winged blackbird perched up on the window.
Now we have a clip from the Dragon Root Project with Evelyn from Pinay.
Hi, everyone. So today we have a special guest with us, and she's just going to talk about this organization she's with. Evelyn, can you introduce yourself?
Hello, everyone. My name is Evelyn Kalugay. I'm a member of Pinay since 1995.
How did Pinay start?
Pinay was formed in 1991. From a focus group of domestic workers who were in the program of foreign domestic movement. And in 1991, the foreign domestic movement was changed into a living caregiver program. When it got started, the focus group decided to form an organization, a Filipino women's organization, and they called it PINAY because they found out that they need each other to support each other in their common issues or problems in the Living Caregiver Program.
What does PINAY do now?
PINAY advocates for living caregivers who are migrant workers who are in a precarious status. Precarious means we say precarious status because they are only holding a temporary status.
So what are the realities of women Filipino migrants?
The realities are the Living Caregiver Program is a very restrictive program. They work as a live-in domestic workers, live-in caregiver, and they have to live in 24 in with their employers, and they have to work 5 days a week, supposedly eight hours a day, mm-hmm. but usually they work over 40 hours, 50 to 60 hours, but they are not paid the overtime pay. But they are supposed to be paid on their overtime pay, but it's very rare that employers will pay them their overtime pay.
So what inspired you to do this work?
It inspired me to do this work. The inspiration that I got from this work was when I found out that there's a group of women who was working as a domestic workers, but they are actually professionals from the Philippines. They were trained as nurses, engineers, doctors, teachers, accountants, but they are working as a live-in caregiver. And me, I find that I felt guilty that I came to Canada to work as a nurse, and I was allowed to work as a nurse. But how come these women, professionals from our country, and they come here and work as a live-in caregiver?
Can you tell us about the LCP?
Okay, the Live-In Caregiver is a program that was created by the government, the federal government, in 1991, but actually it was before that. In the 80s, it was called the Foreign Domestic Movement. But then in 1991, when the conservative government under the leadership of Brian Mulroney, they changed it into the Live-In Caregiver Program, which was more stricter than the Foreign Domestic Movement. The Foreign Domestic Movement, when they come here, even 3 months after or 2 months after, if the employer liked or would like to hire the caregiver for more than a year or two, they will call the immigration and ask them if they could recommend their caregiver to apply for permanent resident. And it takes about 6 months to get their permanent resident. But now, when the Mulroney government came in, they required them to live in 24 months. They have to finish to work 24 months as a live-in caregiver, and if they fulfill that requirement, then they have to apply. They are eligible to apply for permanent resident. If they don't fulfill that requirement, 24 months living in and working as a live-in caregiver, then they have either to repeat or they have to go back home.
What do you do to address the concerns of women you meet in this program?
We usually interview them and get the stories, the whole stories surrounding their concerns. So we will know on how to intervene in their concerns. But actually, we also have a legal clinic information clinic that is manned by law students from McGill.
And how do you teach these women about their rights?
In Pinay, we do a regular educational workshop, seminar, forum on their rights and welfare, so they will know how to fight for their own rights or to assert their rights. We have workshops. We have seminars. Whatever, like we have rights on and responsibilities in the immigration, their immigration and status. What to do whenever they have problems with their immigration papers, if they have to reapply or renew or to transfer their work permit, then we tell them we have those workshops, so they will know what to do.
In these workshops, what kind of ways do you help them? Like, is there a counselor or is there...
We have law students. We have law students who give the workshops. And there's an immigration lawyer that supervises our law students. Or we invite labor lawyers, we invite... experts on human rights, experts on rental housing, so they will know what their obligations, responsibilities, and their rights.
All right, Evelyn, do you have a message to reach out to women in the community?
We would like the women in the community, especially the migrants who have no idea on how to deal with their legal concerns. We have a once a month Pinay information, legal information clinic. We distribute posters, handouts, and we post posters all over the area where we know where the majority of the community is. The informations on the date, on what kind of workshop we are going to have, and we invite them to come, and it's free.
How can people in the community reach out or help? Or and how would they help if they did?
Community could help through, we have community papers by advertising, you know, or putting it out there to reach out Pinay or any organization or any organization in the community who hears something, who has problems, they can recommend or refer them to Pinay.
All right. What kind of changes to the laws do you think need to happen?
We would like the federal government to ratify the convention, UN convention on the for the protection of migrant workers and their families, and also to ratify the ILO Convention, the International Labor Organization Convention on Decent Work for Domestic Workers. So at least when they make the law, they will base it on the framework of these conventions, and also respect the rights based on the charter, individual charter of rights and freedoms of workers when they make the law.
And do you think these changes will happen soon or at all, if anything?
No, this program has been developed. Has been there for more than 20 years, so I guess the law is made or the policies are made based on the economic interest of the rich and forget about the rights of the workers. So this is a long struggle of the workers. It's an ongoing, and that's why, you know, we need the organization who could uphold the rights and welfare of the workers, especially the migrant workers.
All right. Thank you, Evelyn, for being here so much. Is there anything else you would like to add?
I would like to to call out, to reach out for the students in the universities, that the PNAE needs the students. It's our natural resources that could help us, because PNAE has nothing, no funding at all. We only depend on our members and fundraising.
How do you get in touch with the people?
The students or any volunteers who are interested to help us out or to support our struggles can call us at our number, that's 514-364-9833 or 514-238-0089, or you can send us an email at amc@pneiquebec.org, and they can also get information from our blog, pneiquebecblog.com. Also, we have a Facebook page, that's PNAE Quebec.
All right, we've got a great interview episode ready for you today. We had the chance to speak with Tori from Medical Her Story. Medical Her Story is a web-based platform for women and femme-identified folks to share their experiences and challenges in regards to healthcare, medicine, and wellness. This is Tori from the amazing project Medical Her Story. First, for our listeners who aren't familiar with you and the project, can you introduce yourself and tell us about how Medical Her Story came to be?
Of course. So, hi, everyone. My name is Tori. I'm the founder of Medical Her Story. We're an award-winning international nonprofit dedicated to raising awareness on gender health equity through storytelling and undoing stigma. So the project was born out of my own lived experience of dealing with chronic yeast infections and sort of navigating these two really challenging barriers. One was like this lack of medical care or compassion that my ailments were receiving, just because I wasn't being taken seriously, but rather treated as being overly emotional and just making a big deal out of nothing, which I promise you I wasn't. The other one was just this silence that I was living in. We're sort of told from a young age that discussing our bodies, especially our genitals, is very inappropriate, very unladylike, and that these are the discourses that just prevented me from feeling comfortable sharing what I was going through with others. So obviously a lot has changed in those years, as this has become something I talk about quite frequently. And I think what happened is that sometimes silence can just become deafening. I got so fed up with all these invasive exams, lost test kits, unsafe referrals, and just so much pain that I had to say something. So funnily enough, I published a story in the McGill Daily, and it made the front page. It garnered attention from other people starting to share their experiences of medical mistreatment they'd been through, other undiagnosed distress they'd been going through, and just general shame around their bodies. So at the time, I knew that there really wasn't a space to be gathering all these stories, and I really wanted there to be, which is why I created Medical Her Story. And now we publish other women and femmes' firsthand experiences with health and medicine. We hold educational events, workshops, and we go on some podcasts like this one.
Cool. So you mentioned that the project highlights that medicine is not a domain untouched by larger structures like sexism, racism, classism, ableism. Can you elaborate a bit on what that means for this project?
Yes. So I think a lot of people love to believe that medicine is sort of purely objective, factual, and scientific. But if you're in any way marginalized and have ever found yourself in a situation where you're a patient, then you probably know all too well that medical encounters aren't just influenced by these larger inequalities, but that within like clinical spaces, when you're alone with a doctor, these inequalities can actually become even more concentrated on individual bodies. And this can result in a whole range of consequences, from having a lack of access, lost hope, or even lost lives. Because if you're, let's say, low income, racialized, disabled, or femme presenting, you're going to face a medical system that not only has this interpersonal and implicit bias coming from medical personnel, but institutional barriers and systems of oppression that are actually embedded within the care you're getting. So while at Medical Her Story, we do focus more on gender health inequity, we have to acknowledge that all forms of oppression are really intertwined and intersecting, and you can't really even understand or begin to address one if you don't acknowledge all of them.
You mentioned barriers. What are these barriers that women and femmes face in the medical setting?
Everyone's going to have different experiences, but we do know some things from research. We know that many conditions that affect people with vaginas are under research, they're underfunded, and they're underserved. We know that although women are twice as likely to suffer from chronic pain than men, their pain is more likely to be dismissed. We know that in studies where men and women present identical symptoms, that women are more likely to be diagnosed with a mental condition instead of a physical one. We know that it can take years for gynecological issues to be diagnosed or treated. Let's see what else. We know that maternal mortality is 4 times higher for Black birthing people. And we all know that reproductive rights are ongoingly under threat around the world. So I think those are just some examples that are really important to sit with and to understand that behind all these examples is problems that when medical practitioners look at women and when women are seeking out care from a medical practitioner, they're up against this double bind of both such a long history of women being seen as hysterical, overly emotional, or dramatic, which means that their pain is more likely to be dismissed. But then there's also fewer treatments and solutions for when women's pain is actually recognized. Mm-hmm. Moreover, other barriers can include stigma and shame surrounding the femme body. So if you're scared to even talk about what's going on with you, it's harder to get care and it's even harder to form communities of care.
Mm-hmm. My next question is a bit similar. So sorry if I'm repeating myself, but so we talked about barriers in the medical setting, but can you tell us more about how gender bias influences our understanding of illness?
Mm-hmm. Maybe since I've given you some facts here, I can draw a bit more on some lived experience,
mm-hmm.
But also my research. So while I do live with chronic yeast infections, I also have a master's from the University of Cambridge on the subject. So if you do want to learn more, any of our listeners, about my own research, you can check out our YouTube channel. I've published like all our conference talks there and they're pretty accessible, as well as my whole story about suffering with chronic yeast infections is the first one published on Medical Her Story. But chronic yeast infections, if people don't know, 75% of people living with vaginas will get at least one yeast infection in their lifetime, but 5 to 10% will have chronic symptoms that recur on a weekly, monthly, or constant basis and often present for many years. So a yeast infection, if you don't know, means that your genitals can be itching, burning, having weird discharge, and being in a lot of pain. So not very pleasant. And in my own experience, 4 years ago, I first saw a doctor when I had a yeast infection that just wouldn't go away. And this was a really vulnerable setting, right? Like I undressed in front of them, they examined my genitals. I even cried when I was describing the toll that this had taken on my mental health and my daily life. And then I was dismissed with the words, some people get colds, some people get chronic yeast infections. And for a long time, I thought, you know, I'm just seeing weird doctors. I thought maybe this is something I just need to deal with alone and get used to. That's what everyone is telling me. And that's really no big deal. I started conducting interviews with other women about their experiences within the US, UK, and Canada. And I was so shocked to hear that we are facing such eerily similar experiences of being dismissed within medical care, being just told no one cares, get in, get out, facing the social stigma around being worried that other people are going to see us as gross, and just facing a lack of resources because the treatments that are out there just don't work. And there's not enough research going on or funding within women's health to solve these issues right now. And I guess something else I talk about in my dissertation is that chronic yeast infections are just one example of a larger issue. And I coined this the paradox of a normal problem within women's health, which just goes like this. So follow me. If society stigmatizes quote unquote normal genitals as pathological, then genital pathologies become normalized. So that's maybe a bit of a complicated academic way of saying that we live in this society where vulvas and vaginas are stereotyped as being dirty, smelly, or shameful, even when they're not infected. So that when you are infected, you face that stigma on top of the fact that no matter how much you're going to clean yourself or have self-surveillance, nothing's going to make it better. And it's really disheartening because you face this double stigma of sort of the same one that most women or people with vaginas face and suffer with, but then added on top of that, you come to embody this fear that we're all aware of around gross, dirty, or infected genitals. So that's something that I touch upon. That's just one example of how women's pain and suffering within medical care can be dismissed. But even sometimes when we normalize it, we're causing pain also when we tell women that, oh, menstrual cramps are normal, everyone has them. Oh, yeast infections are normal, most people have them. In some ways that can help destigmatize issues, but other ways, in a lot of other ways, it can actually contribute to more harm.
Now, Medical Her Story is a website, and as mentioned, people can submit stories and their experiences. Can you tell us more about the impact that this connection offers women and femme?
For sure. So we've created Medical Her Story as both a site for healing and criticism, because when we write about our own experiences, that's a great way to sort of process what we've been through, to come to terms with something we've been struggling with or trying to understand. So one aspect of medical horror story can stop there once you've put your thoughts onto paper. But the other begins when you share that story. So when you share a story about abortion, vaginal cysts, menstruation, and those stories appear on somebody else's timeline, you're either placing that person within two positions. So as the reader, you're placed in one of two positions, right? Either you read this story and the topic becomes humanized to you or normalized to you. And in that way, you become more sympathetic, more empathetic, more educated. Or you recognize your own experience in this story and you know that you're not alone. Or I guess there's a third option in which you read these stories and think, ooh, gross, but then you're just part of the problem. So in sharing these stories, what I'm trying to say is that we do form this community where it's acceptable and encouraged to discuss our stories of being in these messy, uncomfortable bodies. But it's also a space where we can witness others doing the same and sort of turn to them to be role models.
And what have been some of the submissions that you've received that have made an impact on you?
That's a tough question. And I'm honest when I say that they're all my favorites, but every story we received has really impacted me because I've learned so much about other people's experiences and what they faced. And that's coming from someone who for the past 6 years has been within academic spaces focusing on women's health. So that does say a lot, not only about the education that we lack, but how powerful these stories are, that they're really touching on these issues and touching on them in such a way that's really educating everybody. Because we only really live in one experience, right? But storytelling at Medical Her Story is so raw and vulnerable that it really almost lets you see what it's like through that person's eyes or in their body, in my experience at least. I encourage everyone to read them and see if you have the same experience, but we really try to capture that raw emotion. And being able to read these stories and really feel them is what makes me a better advocate for others and reflect on my own experience by looking at it in different ways too. I'm really proud to have covered so many topics. If you go on the website, we have things ranging from ovarian cancer to miscarriage, eating disorders, autoimmune diseases, queer experiences, pelvic exams, so much more. And in doing so, we try to expand what's traditionally thought of when addressing women's health and open up all of these nuances and details of our experiences from different perspectives. And if you do want me to give an answer, I'll say that two stories that really touched me are Ouchie and So Tight. Funnily enough, they're both about the topic vaginismus, which is a condition where your vaginal muscles can involuntarily contract with penetration of any kind. And that's obviously very painful. Mm-hmm. So in Ouchie, a young woman loses her virginity and is in so much pain and so confused that she visits her doctor, only to be prescribed, not lube, not reassurance, but numbing cream. And in So Tight, however, it details the experience of actually living with vaginismus. So spoiler alert, the first experience was simply a young woman losing her virginity and not using lube. In the second one, we sort of get a glimpse into this complex internal battle that goes on living with vaginismus when sex is painful, but you still really want sex. And essentially, if this makes you a bad feminist. So both of these stories use humor to tell their stories, which I think is great and makes them really accessible to read because they do touch on such a heavy topic. But it just makes it more relatable for those of us who have painful sex for whatever reason and raise awareness on it and sort of normalize those discussions, which I think is a great thing to do for women out there and their partners.
Mm-hmm. What is your hope for Medical Her Story moving forward?
Sure. So my hope is that we can continue to share even more stories. If you're listening and you have one to share, we would love to help you publish it. And my goal is that we can use our voices and experiences to start enacting real change within both society and at the medical level. I want to keep creating this space for connection, education, and advocacy at the same time. And I'll give a little shameless plug that we are recruiting volunteers now. So if you're interested in our mission and would like to help us spread awareness and community, we'd love to have you.
Awesome. I did want to ask also, you mentioned at the top of the interview that you also do events or participate in events. Can you tell us a bit about that and some events that you've done?
For sure. So last Sunday, we held a feminist health research conference where we got to hear from students studying anthropology, sociology, philosophy, and history, all addressing health and women's health from a feminist lens. So it was really interesting to see how you could apply sort of this outlook onto different topics. We looked at migrant health, we looked at painful breastfeeding, gestational diabetes, postpartum depression. So that was a great event we did. We also hold some less academic events, such as sex positive pub quizzes, where you get to learn a lot about different issues. And then what else have we done? Oh, and then we also love to collaborate. So we're going to collaborate with the Thrive Club on an upcoming film screening about women living with chronic illness within Montreal, which we are very excited about.
Oh, wow. Cool. Now, if people want to learn more or join or volunteer, where can they go?
For sure. So you can check out medicalherstory.com to read all our stories or share your own. And you can find us on social media at Medical Her Story. So on Facebook, Instagram, we even have a YouTube channel. So definitely check us out.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Hey. Everyone's health is in our hands, now more than ever. The COVID Alert app on my phone notifies me if I've been in contact with someone who recently tested and declared positive. Protecting my health and that of my loved ones is at my fingertips. I can simply download the COVID Alert app, an app that respects my privacy. Visit quebec.ca/COVID alert to learn how to download the app. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening and welcome. You are tuned in to CKUT's Underground Sounds, and I'm your host, Nick Schofield. I am on the airwaves every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m., playing all Canadian independent music with a local focus on artists from Montreal. This is the Monday, November 9th, 2020 episode, and for the next 2 hours, I will be playing music that has a certain autumnal golden light. It has been unseasonably warm in Montreal lately, and I see everyone drinking in the sunshine, and I hope that this music can convey a similar sentiment. This is Underground Sounds. Stay tuned.